This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Hey, I'm Candace Lim.
And I'm Rachel Hampton. We're the host of ICYMI, Slate's podcast about internet culture.
And we want to help you make sense of the need-to-know internet stories of the week.
Consider us your internet historians of past, present, and future.
Of the good, the bad, and the truly unhinged.
From nuanced takes on stories we're all closely following to the ones you wished you heard about.
In case you missed it, that's ICYMI, the podcast that's extremely online, so you don't have to be. Follow and listen now.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hi, this is Jane Garvey. It's Tuesday, the 20th of August, 2019. It is day two of Listener Week on Woman's Hour. And so everything we're talking about on the programme throughout the week has been suggested by you. There's more on the delights of being a single woman on the programme today, because so many of you want to talk about that. We'll discuss dressing for university as a mature student and ask, are you heartily sick of the wellness industry? Did you get the little gag in there? Because I was really proud of that. I came up with that this morning at 8:30 and I felt rather smug that I'd thought of something so witty and illuminating. And I'm going to pat myself on the back for that, even if no one else is. First of all, this morning, we talked, this is in the light of the conversation yesterday about bringing up boys to be respectful and considerate. This morning, why do so many young women, and not just necessarily that young, get unwanted attention from men and boys when they just walk down the street? A listener called Sarah emailed to say, my daughters are 27, 19 and 13 and they're constantly frustrated by comments and inappropriate behaviour from some boys and men. Please talk about this. It needs its profile raising. As parents, we find it so frustrating as it happens when we're not there. So I talked to Sarah and to two of her daughters, Betty, who's just 13, and Gwyneth, who's 19. And it was Gwyneth we heard from first.
It's quite like a persistent thing, and I've noticed this summer especially, this happens like constantly, from like staring to comments to sometimes having to engage in a conversation because you're not quite sure if you then ignore that person, they might not like that, and then that's a worse situation to be in than to ignore them, kind of thing.
When did it start?
Definitely secondary school. Beginning of secondary school, like on public transport.
Is it boys or is it men?
It's both, but it's so much more men. Yeah, not a lot of boys, but usually they're now younger than me.
What do they do?
Them on their bikes and shouting like, hey, darling, or like, I don't know.
But they're about 4'10"?
But recently I did shout back and they find it so funny, so I'm not going to do it again, and I don't want to be laughed at either, so...
Is it stopping you going out?
No, but there was a point last summer where I was out with two of my friends and there was this crazy guy. He grabbed my friend's thigh and then we like shouted at him and he burst out laughing. He was definitely on drugs or was just not all right. And then the next day it was a similar, felt quite extreme. I can't remember what it was that was shouted at us, but it was quite like gross. And then when I went home, I put on like a long t-shirt and like trousers and I was like, I'm dressing like this for the rest of the summer because I can't, like, it's just, it's too much. And
is it possible for you to go out anywhere without getting some kind of bother?
Yes, but it's rare, especially in the summer.
But you're telling me you have to make a conscious decision about what you wear before you leave the house.
Yeah, and kind of go like, is it worth it?
Betty, you're only 13. But listening to this, what does it make you think?
Well, it's like, I'm not surprised by it anymore, but I just think it's been normalised a bit.
What about you and your friends? Do you, when you go out, have you started to get attention that you don't want?
Yeah, but not. It's not like a lot. It's just like sometimes I'll be walking, like I walk past this guy and like I could see him like staring at me. I looked back at him and like he kept staring at me And I thought, like, when I walked past him, he was going to move, but he didn't. And he stayed there. Like, so his face was, like, really close to mine, and I could tell that he was doing it so he could, like, try and intimidate me. And I think that's the first thing I noticed.
On the face of it, Sarah, this is deeply depressing. How do you help?
Oh, it's really annoying because you feel so helpless. So, I mean, we talk about it a lot, about how you're feeling and things that you can do. I worry about saying, oh, you should be confrontational because you just don't know what reaction you're going to get. So we do talk about not confronting, only because I don't know who's got a knife or who's going to really hurt you. But it's just really frustrating. It's really frustrating. But I think talking about it and talking to your friends about it. But I just worry that, particularly when Gwyneth was talking about very young boys doing it, who are they looking at? Are they looking at their brothers online at things? Where are they being told this is acceptable?
Did you think it would be like this for your daughters?
No, I don't think I did. And I think I first noticed it when our oldest, Morgan, was maybe about 12. And it's like Gwyneth said, on public transport, you start to notice. And I think as parents, we notice before you notice because you don't know it's kind of out there.
I think, I mean, I've got teenage daughters. I can't pretend I haven't had similar concerns. I've also had the conversations when they come down the stairs wearing something and you have to confront the world and you think to yourself, is it OK for her to leave the house like that? In my feminist mind, she's free to dress however she wants.
Exactly.
However, she's in the real world and maybe I should say something to her. Have you been there as well?
Definitely, and I think I have. I think I said to you recently when you were showing me something you were wearing, Gwyneth, do you remember me looking at you? I think that's lovely. You look gorgeous.
You always tell me I look really nice. And
you,
like,
look lovely. But then I've got that other one that's going, but what about the guys on Harrow
You've never
Road?
Told yeah. me not to wear. No, but occasionally you will say, like, be careful, be aware.
Yeah. I do think, though, there are thinking of things that you can do about it. A couple of days ago, Gwyneth told me about walking past a particular pizza place, and every time she goes past there, the guys, if they're standing outside, speak in quite a gross way. So we then disagreed about what should happen. Do you remember what you said?
I said, if something happens, if you walk past a group of people who, you know, speak to you, make you feel uncomfortable, whatever, and you can see that they're attached to an establishment, and I guess you can do that with school kids if that happens, I think you should complain directly to the establishment.
Oh, yeah, but you said they should get fired.
Oh, yeah.
What would be more helpful is if you go in, I'd be happy to go in there with you, and speak to the manager and say, you have people working for you who are speaking
who are
in
this
way.
Yeah.
So you give that manager the chance for her or him to do something first.
Well, can I ask you, Sarah, where did you grow up?
Bedfordshire.
So when you were 90, when you were Gwyneth's age, you were living in what, rural Bedfordshire? Or?
I had just moved here when I was 19.
And what happened to you then, in terms of the amount of harassment and attention?
I just don't think it was. I think there was a lot of attention, but it definitely wasn't as, what's the word?
Overt.
Yeah, and the inappropriateness, the detail, I think, things that some men and boys say.
So for all the progress that's been made, certainly in my life and I'm sure in yours, in any number of ways, we've actually, as it happens, both got daughters who are out in the world, and it's scarier for them than it was for us.
I definitely would agree with that, yeah. Which is ridiculous when you look at all the progress we've made in so many areas. I mean, still lots to do, and yet you still can't go out your front door and be not even respected, just ignored would be nice.
Yeah, honestly, just ignore me. Like, observed and, like, considered.
Considered. I really remember you using that word. That really stuck in my mind to say men are considering me. How dare you consider my daughter?
Is this a new phenomenon, honestly?
I think so. I think they see more of it modelled either in songs, things online.
Yeah,
also,
say,
pornography, I think, has played a really big part in this. How easily available it is. So you do get some boys growing up with this sort of imaginary idea of what a relationship is. Of course you can't then relate to an actual real person.
Well, that was Sarah and her daughters Gwyneth and Betty in conversation with me yesterday. It is depressing. I suppose there'll be many people listening who say, well, same old, tell me something I didn't know. Has it got worse, I suppose, is the question I'm punting out to you today. Has it got worse for our daughters and for our young people just walking the streets of Britain? Do they get more hassle than 30 years ago? And if so, what has changed? So contact the programme if you feel strongly about this one way or the other, and you might think the whole thing has been exaggerated, at BBC Woman's Hour on social media. But our thanks to Sarah and her daughters for being willing to come on the programme. Now, Catherine Venables is here. Good morning to you, Catherine.
Hello.
Good to have you with us. You work as a teaching assistant. You're in your 50s and you have, well, it's not a problem, but you've got a question about the wellness industry, haven't you?
Yes, yeah. I noticed on social media that I was seeing a lot of strategies and therapies designed really to help us with our mental well-being. And, you know, everything from yoga, sound baths, breathing classes, horse therapy, and even things like baking and cleaning, which obviously we all either love or loathe, but does
most, you know, do it.
Yeah,
yeah.
And I'm beginning to wonder: do we, at what point do these therapies tip into actually being harmful for our mental health? Is it another thing that we have to do in order to keep well mentally? Alongside, we've got to look good, we've got to have our house looking good, we've also got to do these things
all
in
right,
order
so
to keep well.
Your concern would be this is one more thing to tick off
yeah,
your list.
Yes.
Okay. I mean, you're a grounded woman with a proper job out there in the real world. So I don't imagine you've got an enormous amount of time to ponder your state of wellness, have you?
Not really. No. I think I do things that I really love and really enjoy. I sing in a choir once a week. We're shocking, and that's, I think, part of the reason why it's so good for us.
Yeah.
I belong to a group. We go walking every week. We always end up in the pub, which, again, is great. Most of us are driving, so it's only going to be a lime and soda.
Good.
But it's just that connection with other people and that exercise out in the outdoors that I think really helps us.
So the wellness industry, how would you define that? What is it?
Yes, it's a bit nebulous, isn't it?
Yeah,
but
well,
I suppose on things like, you know, as I say, those different types of therapies, but also going into podcasts and Instagram, those people that are really promoting taking care of your mental well-being.
Yeah.
And I'm not at all saying it's a bad idea. I think you should be, but at what point does it become unbalanced? At what point is it actually causing you more stress and anxiety? You know, I was talking to somebody at the weekend and she said she suffers from anxiety on and off, and she listens to a lot of podcasts, and she said some days when she's feeling good, they're really inspirational and they really help her. But if she's having a bad day, actually it can make her think, oh, I'm not doing enough. And the anxiety then becomes her fault. If we become unwell, I don't want to use the word ill, because
no.
I think that's a whole,
that's,
you know, that's a
different yeah.
part of the spectrum, isn't it? At what point do we start blaming ourselves
yeah.
for our mental health rather than the situation that we're in?
Let's bring in Pixie Turner, who's a registered associate nutritionist and food blogger. Pixie, good morning to you.
Hello.
And also here, Natasha Devon, who's a body image and mental health campaigner. Hi, Natasha.
Hello.
So let's start then with Pixie. The wellness industry, were you ever a part of it? Are you a part of it now?
I was once a part of the wellness industry, yes. And I came into it for all the wrong reasons, because I was trying to desperately improve my health. And I found all these very impressive, beautiful, shiny bloggers and influencers online who were selling these messages that were very convincing and very
simple.
I'm glad
you used the word selling, because these people, this is a business. They are making money.
Absolutely. I always get told, oh, but they have good intentions. But behind all of that,
they've got good intentions, fill their bank balance.
Yes, it's still a business at the heart of it. And in the end, a lot of what the wellness industry with a capital W is now about is very much about putting a price tag on health and pricing people out of these things that are good for us and that we maybe should or could be doing for our health, but actually we now struggle to do because of the extra financial burden that it sometimes places on us.
Yeah, you are now, you've thought again about all this, didn't you? And you've reinvented yourself, would that be fair?
Yes, I am definitely not part of the wellness industry anymore because I don't want to be part of something that is actually, I believe, causing a lot of harm inadvertently and is prioritising, putting a huge focus on physical health, actually at the expense of mental health a lot of the time.
So you think Catherine's onto something?
Oh, absolutely, yes. In particular, the way that all of this is marketed towards women as being very empowering. And I don't believe it's empowering for women to be sold misinformation. I think it's much more empowering for women to be making decisions about our health based on accurate information.
What is the most dangerous thing you've heard about or something that's been said to you recently in terms of wellness and perhaps the impact of something profoundly dodgy on social media?
A good recent example would be something that's come over from America, which is celery juice. And celery juice is now being painted on Instagram in particular and in Hollywood as being the cure for absolutely everything. It's supposed to be able to cure psoriasis, anxiety. There's even some reports online of people claiming that it cures cancer. Now, this is obviously incredibly problematic because not only is that technically illegal, it's also incredibly harmful because a lot of these messages online are encouraging people away from conventional medicine that works and encouraging them towards these incredibly simple, exciting, but unproven and in the end harmful methods like celery juice, which absolutely, for the record, doesn't really cure anything.
No, it's probably also really horrible.
It's not the most delicious of things. It'll make you a little bit hydrated, but that's pretty much the extent of it.
Well, anything will make you reasonably hydrated. I mean, we only have to look at the stuff that was obviously doing the rounds yesterday, rightly, about MMR and measles. And people, unfortunately, do take on these. They are rubbish, these messages, but people do absorb them. Natasha, what about mental health and the impact of, well, Catherine talked specifically about these podcasts that emphasise, well, I've never listened to one, but you tell me, have you listened to any of them?
Well, I want to say my perspective as a campaigner, this is a motif that you see all the time. You get activists who work really hard and usually free of charge to implement structural change. And then brands see that, they see it making noise and they think, oh, have a bit of that. And as somebody who's been very vocal in body image, you know, the body positivity movement in particular was started by fat women of colour. And they were saying, I don't want to be considered attractive. I just don't want to be discriminated against because of the colour of my skin and my body shape. And yet now it's, you know, anybody who has a roll of fat on them or a wrinkle is trying to get a piece of the body positivity action. And that's not why the movement was created. So I understand the frustration. And with mental health, you know, a lot of the time we need to look at structural changes that will help people rather than this narrative of personal responsibility. And I think that's what Catherine's talking about.
But bringing about structural change is not easy to do. Mm. And there are a lot of people out there who do have to earn a crust, as we all do. And frankly, they've found a way of doing it. They may not be learned, they may not be qualified, but they can still bank a few bob on the back of promoting, frankly, a load of tosh.
The problem is, I think, that if you're going to speak about mental health, it's a highly scientific thing. You know, I, for example, have a bank of experts in neuroscience, psychology, psychiatry, who I consult with to make sure that I am getting the science right when I'm working with vulnerable young people. A lot of the celebrities in particular who have waded into this space don't understand the basic distinction between mental fitness and mental illness. Now, there are things that you can do to improve your mental fitness, like mindfulness, like exercise, which, as you rightly pointed out, is magnified when you do it in nature, the benefits of it. But that's not going to cure mental illness. And because we have quite a limited amount of words to have this mental health conversation, I think the messages are becoming confused. And it's like you were saying, Pixie, you know, people claiming that if you spend thousands of pounds of going on a silent yoga retreat and it's going to cure your bipolar disorder, that is an incredibly dangerous message.
Yeah, I mean, I think, Catherine, tell me, is this what you're thinking about and you're concerned about, or are you thinking on a more practical level? Because most people don't have thousands to spend on yoga retreats, however much they might fancy the idea.
Yeah, and I think it's, you know, as women going about our ordinary everyday lives, how do we make sure that we're looking after ourselves for our sake and the sake of the people around us? How do we look after our mental wellness without it becoming yet another stick we beat ourselves with, because we are very good at that as women.
And I think, to be fair, I mean, you and I are around the same age. Yeah. It doesn't actually get any easier, does it?
No.
You and I are still receiving the same messages that make us concerned about our appearance or whatever it might be. I suppose they're rather different messages to the ones our kids might be getting, but we're still getting them.
Yeah, yeah.
And it can drag you down, Natasha. Yeah. So what do you do?
I mean, mindfulness is any activity...
Yeah, how do you define it?
Mindfulness is any activity that you can do that stops you from dwelling on the past or worrying about the future. So it can be knitting, it can be running. It doesn't have to be doing meditation or yoga or any of the fancy things it's been repackaged as. And back when human beings were living a tribal existence, a period of mindfulness during the day was what allowed us to process the things that had happened, store things in long-term memory, and learn from the events of the day. It should be entirely free of charge. It should be a basic human right. But it's kind of unsexy when you frame it like that. You know, I'm sure you agree, Pixie, that nutrition advice is kind of unsexy as well. It's like, eat your fruit and veg, drink enough water, don't overthink it.
Mm. Absolutely so true.
That's a very short book, though, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
Very short. Yeah, you can't really sell much on that kind of message. But it's true, with food, again, there's this very kind of sexy message about, oh, eat this food and it will cure sorts of conditions, or eat this food and you'll feel amazing. It's the miracle cure, or it's the miracle thing that's going to give you more energy. And actually, although food cannot cure things like depression, but food can absolutely contribute to you feeling a little bit better about yourself, and especially about your body. When you're feeding yourself well and you're treating yourself with good food from a position of self-respect, that can genuinely make you feel better about the body that you're living in without you changing anything about your appearance.
Yeah. Celery juice. Ever had it, Catherine?
No.
Don't recommend.
Love celery, though.
Do you?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, crunchy celery with a bit of hummus. Absolutely beautiful. And you get all the benefits from it if you eat it just as it is rather than juicing it. You actually get fewer benefits from it when you juice it, so doesn't make any sense either.
A quick word from you, Natasha, on a go-to food place.
A go-to food place? Yeah. I have absolutely no qualifications in this area.
Doesn't matter, so I haven't got any. I was going to say something.
I mean, I feel like carrot cake and a cup of tea can make you feel better about most things.
Yeah, I would absolutely. Yeah, although I'm not keen on carrot cake.
Pizza,
in fact,
for me.
It's my least favourite cake. Lemon drizzle is my least favourite.
That's
cake.
Controversial.
Well, I'm a very controversial broadcaster. Natasha, thank you very much, and Catherine, thank you, and Pixie, thank you for coming in. Any thoughts on that? Of course, you can contact the programme. Interesting. I knew we would get a tweet like this, and of course we have. This is from Catherine. When I was young in the 70s and 80s, and you know what's coming, a wolf whistle or a hello darling could make my day. However, she goes on to say, but I never recall comments of a degrading or sexual nature. Was it a more polite society, more decorous towards women? Sarah says, I've been angry about harassment for 50 years. There is plenty that men can do about their behaviour. And let me see, there's another one here. Jane says, when harassed in the street, my friend's daughter holds up her phone to take photos and yells very loudly, I've got photos, I've got your car, Reg, I'm going to your school, stroke wife, stroke police, and it does the trick. Oh, how I wish we'd had phones when I was growing up. More on that, welcome, of course. You can contact the programme however you like. Now, throughout the course of this week, every single idea, every subject on the programme has been suggested by you. And tomorrow, Jenny's going to be investigating what it's really like inside the PTA. And she'll talk, too, about women and endurance sports. And on Friday, it's me again, and we're talking about cooking for yourself after bereavement. This was inspired by a number of emails we had recently on that subject. What it's like to suddenly find yourself cooking for one and how difficult that can be. Now, our next listener is Annie Dehaney-Stephen. Annie, welcome to the programme.
Good morning.
Now, you are going back to university. First of all, congratulations.
Thank you.
What are you going to be doing?
I'm going to be doing a master's in music, mind and brain.
Wow.
As psychology master's.
That sounds absolutely fantastic. Yeah. Has this been a long-term ambition?
It's been something I'm interested in. I'm a scientist, was for many years. I now teach maths and science, or I have been teaching maths and science, and I wanted to do a master's, and I'm a singer and a musician. So it encompasses everything that interests me and maybe the start of a new life.
Well, I really hope it is for you. So, no, I'm excited for you. Your dilemma is what?
I'm 59 years old, I'm going back to university, and I don't know what to wear. I don't want to look like mutton dressed as lamb, and I don't want to look like an old lady. I want to look right for me.
Well, I don't think there's much chance of you looking like an old superstar, so you can pack, you can forget that one. What if you were to describe your personal style, what would you say?
My personal style is a black skirt, a coloured T-shirt and a pair of trainers. I do have a pair of rather disreputable jeans as well.
Right. Disreputable in the sense that your family give you stick for wearing them.
My family hate me wearing trainers with skirts, and yeah, my jeans are pretty disgusting.
OK, brilliant. Well, Alice Wilby is here, personal stylist and consultant. And Alice, it would be fair to say you're into sustainable fashion.
Yes, that's right.
And Felicity Kay is the fashion editor at Elle magazine. Welcome to you, Felicity. So first of all, Alice, what would you say? Is Annie right to be even remotely concerned about sticking out a bit, or should she just forget it and just be herself?
I think she should forget it and be herself. We've been chatting in the green room and she's a wonderful, engaging, warm, funny, interesting person who's going to get along great at Goldsmiths. But I'd also say that she's not going to be on her own and worrying about what to wear on the first day back at uni, because everybody, regardless of their age, shape, size, preference of clothing, is going to be feeling anxious about what they wear on that first day. So that's the first thing I'd say. You're not going to be alone in that worry.
It is a concern, isn't it? Because you want to be accepted. And it's hard. Entering any new environment is a difficult thing to do. Students like to think of themselves as individual, and yes, I have to say Goldsmiths is probably, I think I'm right in saying, one of the more fashionable establishments. Would that be right?
Yes, but it's still very artistic and bohemian, it's not a fashion college in that sense.
Yeah. It's quite celebratory of individuality and...
Yeah.
Yeah.
So actually, absolutely. Felicity, you'd say that Annie's hit on a place where she can simply be herself and be at ease.
Oh my God, absolutely. And we were talking about this earlier, this sort of sense that going into a life transition, one of the first questions I get asked as a fashion stylist at Elle is, what do I wear? But also, what do I buy? People often have that knee-jerk reaction of rushing to the shops, dressing themselves head to toe in something brand new, and then often run the risk of feeling like they're in a costume, ultimately.
That isn't them.
Yeah, and I think the best place to start is to go back into your own wardrobe, find that piece that you really love and you feel comfortable in. And university is such a casual environment. I mean, when I was at university 10 years ago, people were wearing pyjamas, so...
Yeah.
Don't do that. That's absolutely not what I'm suggesting.
No, I would have to buy pyjamas.
Yes. I've long since abandoned nightwear. God, what a horrific image for the nation that is. Really, sometimes I do forget where I am, which isn't good. What about the notion that... I know you say go back, find a piece you love. Most of us don't keep stuff or don't have stuff expensive enough that we thought worth keeping in the first place, or we don't have the storage space. So what do we do?
Well, I think one place to start is to think about the things that you have loved in the past and maybe you've let go of because they didn't fit anymore, they didn't suit you, and those things still exist if it's an amazing dress or a jacket, and buy quality over quantity. Don't rush out and buy lots of cheap bits and pieces.
All right, so if you were going to do that, what would you prioritise this autumn? Is it a good jacket? Is it a coat? What is it?
Well, September, an amazing blazer. There's a return of a lot of heritage check and that kind of 80s, sorry, dare I say it, silhouette with jeans and a T-shirt, which I think a lot of people will be a bit horrified by.
This isn't the shoulder pads, is it?
A little bit. There's a little bit of that bigger shoulder coming back. So if you do have a jacket from the 80s, don't be afraid to dig it out, but maybe throw it over a dress that you love and that you already own and you feel comfortable in.
Annie, does that ring any... Have you got any power shoulders?
I gave up my power shoulders quite a long time ago when the rest of me became wider than my shoulders. I decided not to bother with shoulders anymore. But I do have a few things that are that old, from the 80s. I'm not sure that they should see the light of day. I've kept them for sentimental reasons.
I think maybe you need a private consultation with Alice or Felicity or both. In terms of sustainability, Alice, what are the things that are worth keeping genuinely?
Well, things that you love and things that you really enjoy wearing. I mean, you know, you just hit the nail on the head. So many of us throw things away or get rid of them because we, you know, we get stuck into this constant cycle of buying and consuming. But actually, when you really love things, you don't need a new piece. You've already got the thing that you adore. So the idea is to, you know, mend it, take care of it, keep it in your wardrobe for as long as possible. But also when you find a shape or a silhouette that really suits you, to stick with that. And we were talking in the green room about performing, and Annie's an amazing jazz singer and gets dressed up in these beautiful dresses voices for her performances, and she described them so wonderfully, and your face lit up.
Yeah.
And they sound like they're evening dresses because you're doing shows, but perhaps you might want to go and, you know, investigate getting something made in that style that's a bit more dressed down that you could wear during the day, and then you can bring that confidence and that sort of stylish confidence that you exude on stage, just bring a little element of that into your day-to-day.
It would mean having to wear makeup for me. A really nice fitted dress would mean makeup, and I, except for evenings, except for gigs,
yes,
really, I don't wear
makeup.
Bother. I don't want that half hour lost in the morning.
But I'm completely with you on that one. I barely wear anything myself, and I love a dress. Absolutely love a dress. And when you get the right one, you don't need a face full of makeup. Yeah. It could just be, you know, a really great shoe or a really wonderful, you know, jacket that goes with it.
Really quick. Well, I mean, most students I know wear trainers and tracksuit bottoms,
yeah,
and hoodies and something else.
Well,
that's
it's
because
comfort.
But they yeah, really do. I mean, it's, yeah, we haven't really moved on from your pyjamas. We've just moved into a slightly different form
sort of
pyjama.
Sort of a more elevated, sportier version,
yes,
of.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. What about footwear? I mean, I know Annie likes trainers. She should really just maybe invest in a good pair of trainers.
I mean, absolutely. The thing that you really, you know, is going to make you feel really stylish is your confidence.
Yeah.
And to be really confident in your clothes, you need to be comfortable in them, first of all. If you're not comfortable, then you're going to feel, you know, awkward, and that's going to come across. So, yeah, really great trainers, really nice, comfy trainers, absolutely.
I must say, my best woman, Sue, yes, recently wore a beautiful dress to my wedding and a pair of silver trainers.
That sounds really fabulous.
There you go, that might be the way to dress down one of your dresses.
I think you're going to really enjoy yourself, and I suspect by day three you'll have long since forgotten about whether you're wearing the right thing. I think you'll have a great time. I'm really jealous. It sounds like a real adventure for you, and I hope you enjoy it, Annie.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, and thank you too as well, Felicity.
And
we also had the contribution of Alice. Thank you both very much. Alice Wilby and Felicity Kay, and our listener was Anna Dehaney-Stephen, who's going back to uni in the autumn. Now, when we talked to Kathy Burke about her Channel 4 series All Woman, she talked about being single and how much she enjoyed it. And Anne Parks was our guest as part of Listener Week yesterday. Anne got divorced as she headed for her golden wedding anniversary, and many people were inspired by hearing from her. Danielle tweeted to say, "Positive woman who chose to divorce in her later years, reinforcing my long-held view, it's better to be on your own than to settle for a relationship which doesn't make you happy." Well, that's true, of course, but it doesn't mean that being single is necessarily easy. Many of you wanted us to talk about being single this week, including a listener called Karen, who says, "I'm a single childless woman. Right, that's that off my chest. I'm really, really thrilled that the world, or at least a Woman's Hour contributor, has woken up to the fact that we're not all sectionable, fit for dunking, or worthy only of cast-off pity. I am 60, single and childless. I have many friends in the same situation, and we have a great life. I'm a nurse with a great career and career opportunities and projects which are likely to keep me active, healthy and fulfilled until I'm 70. Well, Karen then went on to explain that she's now working in France, so she wasn't able to come on the programme today, but we do have other women willing to talk about this and willing to talk about the positive side of being single. So I'll introduce them now. Bibi Lynch is with us, 53, presenter at BBC Sussex and Surrey, host of the station's WIPS programme. Bibi, that's right, isn't it?
That's correct.
Now, tell me a bit about WIPS. What's that?
You're a whip. Women
so
who are
am.
Hot. You're so totally. You're chief whip.
Oh,
women who
you.
Are hot, intelligent, and in their prime. How about that?
Intelligent. Well, we'll leave that. Yeah, I'll settle for some of the rest of it. Emily Hill is here, novelist, author of Bad Romance. Welcome to the programme, Emily. And you are in your early 30s.
Yes.
Okay. That's right.
No, you said slightly massaging my age there. I'm 36.
36? That's
I'm
fine.
I'm happy for that.
All right. And Joy is a listener in our Nottingham studio. Hi, Joy.
Hi.
Tell us a bit about your life, Joy.
Yeah, well, I'm 42. I'm single. I do have a child. He's 9 years old. And I was married when I was pregnant with him. But I had him at my mum and dad's place because I had to leave my husband at the time. So I've been a single mum since I was 6 months pregnant, really. Yeah, and that's me.
And do you feel remotely judged, Joy?
I have to say that in my own head, before I gave birth, I thought I would be, and I was judging myself almost very harshly. But the reality of it was, when I got out into the world with my little boy, people couldn't have been more positive, and frankly, you know, didn't bat an eyelid, which was great.
So where does this perceived negativity about your singledom come from?
I don't know. It's hard to say whether it's a kind of an inbuilt thing that women, you know, it's just in our DNA almost over the years, in novels, in films, and maybe we're sort of, we just feel like that, I guess. But then when the reality hits you as a person, you can find it so very, very different.
I mean, you're right about the novels, but that's sort of Jane Austen territory, isn't it?
Well, yeah,
Emily,
maybe.
What would you say about that?
Well, I think that's right. It is very, very embedded in our culture. That's why I actually started writing about single women as a phenomenon, because my first book, Bad Romance, it's short stories, and they're about all sorts of women, but most especially single women, because I don't think that we are represented in the culture enough. I think what's happened is when single women were new in the 90s, there was Carrie Bradshaw, there was all the girls in Sex and the City, there was also Bridget Jones. Bridget Jones is married with a baby now. All the Sex and the City figures, and there's no... And then what we have now... we had girls, and they're all in their 20s, and it was, I just couldn't relate to it at all. And then we have Fleabag, who's this kind of terrifying vision of what a single woman might be. And cultural representations of women through single women throughout history, I mean, you know, now, like, you're sort of, people will say, oh, you know, you don't get a cat, you know, don't get a cat. And it's like, well, why shouldn't I have a cat if I like cats? But it's this kind of vision of women as witches, and, you know, we used to get burned to the stake, and now, you know, we're suffered to go on all these horrible internet dates because society kind of expects us to at least be trying to get married.
All right, Bibi, what did you say? Trying to get married. Go on.
Trying to get married. I think, I mean, single and childless is the double whammy of pity, the poor Jen head tilt, the pity. I was at a funeral. Listen to this. I was at a funeral.
Yeah, I can't believe this story, but carry on.
Yeah, and a woman who apparently I'd met before and I don't recall came up to me. My sister had to hold me back, and she said to me, so, did you get married? And I went, no. And then she went, did you have children? And I said, no. And she went, oh well, well done anyway. It's not for everyone. So we're at a funeral.
Well done on continuing to breathe.
Breathing. Yeah. It's so extraordinary how we are judged. And I think that's proven by that research that came out from an LSE professor recently, who said that childless and single women are the happiest in society. That went viral. because we felt that we were being acknowledged. But I actually found it really patronising, because that proved that added to it.
What do you mean? Because, by the way, that wasn't new. I remember being taught that in psychology at university back in the 80s.
That we're the happiest?
Yeah, that actually marriage was good for men, but not psychologically not brilliant for women.
Well, I think it was seen as an insight and an explosion of insight, because we're told we're not, we're pitied, and we're judged. And yeah, if you get a cat, you know, you've gone into the crazy territory. I mean, I don't understand it. I don't understand the head tilt. I don't, because guess what? I'm not the one. I can't see that someone with 2.4 children and being married to a man or woman is any necessarily more happy than I am, because I'm not sitting here wanting to kill someone because of the sound they make when they eat a baguette. You know, I have a great, really great life. I'm straddling happy, but I'm not allowed to be happy because I'm told I'm not allowed to be happy.
Oh, that's interesting.
And that's the worst thing about it.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, I follow you on Twitter. You're very funny.
Sorry about the language.
Yeah. Well, you can be. yeah, there is that. But you can be a bit bleak sometimes. You acknowledge there is another side to this, isn't there?
Oh, but there's another side to being married and a parent as well.
Of course, yeah.
But that's not allowed. And the reason we're not shown that, because of all the fake book posts, and that's where I think and I will call it bigotry, actually. I think that's where the prejudice comes from, in that people are maybe threatened. I mean, you know, I'd love to be in love. That doesn't mean I want to be married. Because I can't commit to a shampoo. So I don't know if I could be with someone forever and ever. But... you know, we're told these Facebook posts kind of tell us that life is this and life is that, but we all know the reality isn't that. But they're perpetuating a myth that doesn't help them or doesn't help us. It's so damaging. Can I say one thing? The people that I interview a lot of young people, and they seem to have a really great take on this because they're polyamorous, they're pansexual, they're in thruples, ladies. So that's a man and a woman, and then they've got a girlfriend or a boyfriend. This is extraordinary. They're exhausted, but they're happy because they don't have the confines of the role models that I feel that we're still suffering.
Yeah, I mean,
of.
The thing, if you're in a throuple, and I haven't got the energy, obviously, but I mean, doesn't that mean that possibly two people could annoy you with the way they eat a baguette? I mean, let's be honest. It's not Emily, what would you say?
I agree entirely. I don't understand that urge at all. But I do completely agree that, you know, it's difficult to. One of the issues that we face, I think, as single women is if we want to have children, I would love to have children, that becomes a major problem. And there's this phenomenon that isn't talked about, I think, because we're women, of social infertility. It's like, I agree completely. I would love to fall in love.
What's social? Oh, I see.
Social infertility. You just can't find anybody to fall in love with and have a baby with. And this is not, I mean, I think, and then we're all blamed, you know, for the falling birth rate. And that's entirely our fault, rather than actually it's not finding a man who, you know, wants what we want and can give that to us or would want to give that to us. And I think the thing is there are many, many upsides to being single, and those aren't talked about either. Talking about things going viral, I did a piece for The Guardian about the price of being single and how we're kind of penalised against there, and that went around the world. I had emails from women in Iraq saying, thank you for pointing this out.
Well, and this is just for anybody who doesn't know, what is that actually? What do you mean by that?
The cost of being single? Well, okay, so we're penalised in the tax system in terms of if we live on our own, then we get a small decrease in council tax, like the single person supplement. But in terms of how much we're paying in comparison with a married couple, it's a big price. And then there's just so many other ways, like even the National Trust. You know, if you're in a couple, it's cheaper to go to the National Trust. But the thing is I think that it's important to kind of celebrate what we can do and what... And our kind of abilities to be happy, just as it's important to also admit that there's a downside, like there is a downside to marriage, for instance. One of my friends said, it's not just a case of, in terms of creativity and what you want to do with your life and having things that you want to achieve, it's not just the pram by the door, it's the toothbrush by the sink. And I think that we do tend to, in relationships, we've been kind of taught to put a man first. And so maybe one of the things that's so attractive about being single to women is the chance to actually go, you know, we're only alive so long. I've got things I want to achieve and I can concentrate on that.
And this is about me.
Yes.
Yeah, OK, no, I get that. And Joy, I know at the moment you're prioritising your young son. He is only young.
Yeah.
Of course, he won't be staying at home with you forever.
No, that's right. But I completely agree with what I've just heard, you know, in terms of finding that I have time if I wish to, which I do, you know, as well as running my own business and looking after my son, I have time to go and play tennis and paint and printmake and go to life drawing classes, all things which, you know, if I had to stay at home and do ironing, God forbid, or, you know, cook huge family meals, I couldn't do.
Joy on the real pleasures of her single life. And Emily is still here. So too is Bibi. Right, Sabina emailed to say, or tweeted actually, I think, I was widowed after 44 years of marriage and I was actually dreading being on my own, but it gave me a chance to discover myself. Solitude in moderation is a wonderful thing. Otherwise, I've got my friends and my garden, I've got my hobbies, my time and freedom to pursue them. I am content. Jessica says, having been single for most of my 50 years and very happily so in my late 40s, I found those that were most uncomfortable and judgmental of this were women in long-term, unhappy relationships. Now, Emily, you're nodding.
I am nodding, yes.
But you recognise that?
Well, the thing is, it's like you never know what's going on in somebody's marriage, but people will come up to you routinely whenever you see them, even at funerals, apparently, as we heard.
Yes.
And sort of ask, you know, about your single status, and you'd never, ever dream of turning around to them and saying, you know, How often do you sleep with your husband? You know, or anything that would allude to what's going on.
Is he
on
still
there.
Using the Viagra?
Exactly.
I'm so horrible.
But you're sort of like, and especially like even young girls, you know, in their 20s, they're sort of asked, you know, like you'd ask about the weather, you know, about their marriage plans, you know, in the future, or whether they want to have children in a way that, you know, wouldn't be said to a man. But also like you're kind of being asked to explain very, very personal decisions to which you might not have even made yet, which I find, but I mean, I don't want to be too critical about that because often it's, you know, people just trying to make conversation. But it is, I think that because you're single, I think there is, it's a little bit, we're so accepting of alternative lifestyle choices in every single way. And I think the one remaining thing, maybe because all the other lifestyle choices, like there's gay marriage, so that's kind of, acceptable and brilliant and wonderful, and everybody has the same rights to get married, and that's great. But that kind of the opposite side of that is like you just are considered more weird if you're single, especially if you're happy being single. If you're kind of running around after men in sort of a chicklet style way,
but that's perceived then, to be doing the right thing.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Isn't that right, Bibi? That people understand if you're in hot pursuit of a, you know, in heteronormative relationships, a man, they get that. It's the women who say, oh, I've pulled up the drawbridge and I couldn't be happier.
Yeah, I think it's because you're kind of shining a light on their decisions, which, again, we're not allowed to comment on. It's what you're saying about the most personal questions are allowed to be asked of you if you are single and childless. You know, why haven't you had children? Why are you still single? You know, why are you talking to me? Don't bring this stuff to me. It's, do you know what I think the worst thing is that you're made to feel shame around it. You're made to feel like you've made the wrong decisions. You might have made the best decision for you. That's what I don't understand about this. I don't have these judgments about other people. I really try not to, but people seem to be A, happy to do it, and B, really fierce with it as well. I mean, the childless thing is a huge factor for me, and social infertility is a huge deal. There's a woman called Jodie Day who
she's been on the program. Yeah,
she's fantastic, and she's the founder of Gateway Women, which is an organisation, it's a support group for women who are childless not by choice, childless by circumstance. And she talks about pronatalism, and I'd never heard of that word, and now it's all I have in my head, because pronatalism is worshipping at the altar of parenthood, and there is this perception that you are more if you're a parent, you're better, you're suddenly almost a deity as a mother rhetoric, hardworking families rhetoric, and that spills over to being married or in a long-term relationship too. And it's just so unhelpful. It's pressure for the people who are parents and in long-term relationships, because they have to live up to what they see as the dream. Because if they're unhappy, why are they unhappy? Because they've got the best thing ever. And it's really depressing and horrible for people who don't have that, because we feel like, as Beyonce said, I found myself when I had children. Well, that's very helpful, Beyonce. Thank you so much. Because that makes the rest of us feel like we're nothing. We're all something. We're all brilliant. I find it extraordinary that we can't be allowed in 2019, and exactly as you say, when we're trying to find equality everywhere else, it's not allowed here. And it seems so normal and so easy to get that, you know, I'm just not married. That's it.
Beyonce has so much to answer for in a certain way, because she's held up as this amazing feminist figure, and it's like she's very, very married. She's very, very got the children. You know, the single ladies, he liked it so he put a ring on it, and then the single ladies, uh-oh. I mean, that's basically what we do. It's like, uh-oh.
And what was going on with Becky with the great hair or the good hair? You know, she's also,
I think I was
going to
say that. Some would say she's made a few compromises. But then who doesn't? In any sort of relationship. By the way, somebody took issue, I can't remember who it was, someone on Twitter took issue with your, I think you said something about Fleabag.
Yes.
That terrifying image of, and somebody's asked, what did you mean by that?
Well, I think the interesting thing about Fleabag is, first of all, she's called Fleabag. She doesn't have a name, which, and she kind of goes around in this absolutely desperate state, The other thing is I've got so many problems with Fleabag, and I know this was going to make me violently, violently unpopular.
No, I'm interested.
The first series of Fleabag was all about, for me, the most beautiful and wonderful thing about being single is how much time I can still devote to my female friends. And this kind of, it was just a horrific vision of a woman, you know, who her best friend, you know, she's such a sex maniac. And that's the other thing that we get. Fear as women. It's like, I think a lot of women think that we're after their husbands, or if they're not, or their sons, or, you know, or any kind of, you know, because we're supposed to be these desperate figures who just want a man. Whereas what's, I think, more empowering is actually accepting Rebecca Traister, who did this brilliant book called All the Single Ladies, you know, pointing out that there's more single women alive today than at any point in history. We have our freedom, we have choice, and we're not really examined. We're not really, you know, looked at as like a new way to live, or why we might want to live there. And I suppose
no, because it threatens something.
Yeah, I mean, one of my, so I've the most popular, there's two that are most popular of my short stories. One where this woman goes to a party dressed all in head to toe in leopard print, and that's very terrifying. Leopard print is very terrifying. That's just being single times to the max, you know, like terrifying woman. So that she got, anyway, it's unfolds in disaster. It's all online. It's quite funny, hopefully. And the other one is this literally like a sort of my solution to how to be single at parties, because it's single at parties, you have to have a whole repertoire of retorts in your arsenal. So as a single woman confronted by, because we still haven't got past the Bridget Jones, that classic line of Bridget Jones when she's at a dinner party, everybody else has a partner, and you get asked, why are there so many single women your age, Bridget? And you know, it's like, and you just have to say, well, there's scales under my clothes, you know, like and also the things like, I, you know, there's plenty more fish in the sea, you'll get told, and then so I always think, well, you could, well, but yeah, the cod stock decline is alarming. Sperm whales are endangered species. All, you know, you're looking in the wrong places. Well, I tip my handbag out. I don't think he's in the fridge. You know, like all these kind of things, and people are being kind, they're being nice, but there's just this kind of, there's this level of being happy in yourself that they don't get. And I love the fact that Women's Hour listeners all said, yeah, let's talk about being happy and being single, because I really think it's something that we need to talk about more.
Bibi, the trouble is, this conversation, there isn't an equivalent programme for men like no. Women's Hour. I know Men's Hour exists sometimes on Five Live. It's not on all the time. But single men, would single, I don't know.
I think what? Single men get a bad rap, you know, because okay. At least we've got exactly what you say, at least we've got a place to talk about it, and amongst our friendship groups we do as well. Mm. Because again, I write a lot about being childless. I've had such moving tweets and conversations with men who are single without kids, who, one man who won't go to any social event now because he can't face it. He can't face the conversation. He can't face, because it's emasculating as well as anything else. You know, we feel hardwired as women to have children. I think men feel hardwired in that kind of I am man way to produce several. You know, it's across the board awkward. What you're saying about that, where we're seen as predatory, we're seen as cheap as well, as up for it. You know, and I mean, the whips thing was, I wrote a piece for Stella, and I was writing about that younger men find older women attractive. Brilliant. And I wrote, but I didn't want to write about cougars, because I really don't like that expression, because it's predatory, and it's like, it's not that complimentary to the man or the woman. So I came up with the acronym WHIPS. And that can be used across the board here. It's powerful, and it's, you know, it's not just about relationships, it's about attitude. And if you are single and you want to do whatever you want to do, you are allowed to do that. But there's no, as you say, there's no equipment for men, I don't think. I feel sorry for men in this case.
All right. Bibi, thank you very much. Appreciate you coming on. Emily, good to have you on the programme as well. I just wanted to read a couple of your thoughts on the street harassment and the attention, unwanted attention, that young women, although not always young, are getting. Sue says, I'm 57 and I've got an abiding memory of being 13 and a bus conductor calling out loudly, if I said you had a beautiful body, would you hold it against me? Well, I never wore anything that in any way revealed my shape for the next 12 years. But I still had to enjoy
endure regular comments about my body. It was incredibly confusing and so hard to develop a healthy, strong sense of self at a time when I needed that more than anything. Mary says the vile men who call out at teenagers or young women just walking in the world, please stop. Men, if you see this, can you also stop them? They won't listen to us. Rachel says, when I was this age, we all put up with bum-pinching and comments, thinking it was just the way of the world. I hope this generation knows it isn't the way of the world and they are well within their rights not to put up with it. My second thought is, what is being done at schools to challenge boys about this behaviour? Dave says, my daughter's 20. She had a young lad airdrop a topless pic of himself onto her phone. He was sitting next to her. Awkward isn't strong enough a word. Apparently, this is a trend. From Carol, my youngest daughter would get sexualised comments from men driving by her on her journey to and from school when she was in uniform. What do these men expect will happen as a result of this exchange with an underage teenager, was her repeated question. These were not teens on the street, but predatory adult men in their cars. All I could say to my girls was, I'm sorry, but not all men are like that. Three of them now have delightful partners who would never dream of behaving like this, so there is hope. How do we educate the upcoming generation to be like my daughter's partners and not like the disgusting catcallers? And from Linda, unfortunately this has always happened. One consolation of getting older is that you do become invisible. Well, that's not a terrifically positive place to stop, but that's where we've got to go. So thank you all for a really brilliant interaction throughout. Listener Week's always a popular thing with the listeners, oddly enough. And it's great that so many of you are so keen to get your views to us. Thank you very much. Please continue to do it. And Jenny is here tomorrow.
I'm Sheila Dillon, and before you go, I wanted to tell you about the Food Programme podcast, the place for hungry minds. In our latest episode, I sit down to talk to Jamie Oliver.
We used to go and pick sorrel and rocket on roundabouts. And I'm like, yeah, but Gennaro, it's kind of a lot of exhaust fumes around here, Gennaro. Lead, Gennaro, not good.
It was wonderful to hear that Jamie Oliver, master of Italian cooking, actually only encountered olive oil in his late teens.
My geography teacher, Mr. Saggers, said that I was deaf. In Essex, the only place to get olive oil was Boots.
So, subscribe to the Food Programme on BBC Sounds.
Candace Lim.
And I'm Rachel Hampton. We're the host of ICYMI, Slate's podcast about internet culture.
And we want to help you make sense of the need-to-know internet stories of the week.
Consider us your internet historians of past, present, and future.
Of the good, the bad, and the truly unhinged.
From nuanced takes on stories we're all closely following, to the ones you wished you heard about.
In case you missed it, that's ICYMI, the podcast that's extremely online, so you don't have to be. Follow and listen now.